Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I will be continuing to talk about our unconscious mind and the way our unconscious mind protects us from changes that we think we'd like to make or that our conscious mind thinks we'd like to make, but which would not actually be in our best interests at this time. I'm also going to play part of an interview I did with Judy Lyons Schneider, a remarkable artist and a charming person. So that will be coming up right now. Show. You heard me say I'm going to talk about your unconscious, and I'm going to play an interview with, or part of an interview with, Judy Lyons Schneider. More and more, I find that I am talking longer and longer to people in these interviews, and I simply cannot get the whole interview in one show. So if you were listening in the last 2 weeks, you heard that I had to spread Henry Ettman out into two shows, and I have to do that with Judy as well. Not sure whether that's just that I have become more interested, or the people I'm talking to have become more interesting. I don't actually know, but that's what's going on. So you're going to hear part of an interview. And also, in this show, I'm going to continue my opinion poll of how should I begin and end my show, with what kind of music, or at least with what of my music, since it is The Lynn Show and I do get to start and end the show with my own music. I'm asking my listeners to go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Click on Contact Me and tell me if you think that I should start the show with You Really Can, that you just heard, and end the show with I Won't Go With a Whimper, which you will hear if you listen for the whole show. or if I should reverse them, or if I should use a different song from my CD. And I will be playing two more songs from the CD in this show as well. But before I talk about the unconscious, and before I play any songs, and before I play my interview with Judy, I want to tell you about an experience I literally just had. I'm recording this show in July. I think, if I have it correctly, that you're listening to it towards the end of August. But I have to pre-record these shows, and I have to pre-record a number of them because I'm going to be gone for about a month starting August 7th, and I won't be able to be recording any shows, so I need to get way ahead. So it's July, and I live in Sarasota, Florida, a very wonderful place to live. And all of us are grateful. We have been getting a lot of rain. We're grateful because we have a drought. I'm grateful because I'm one of the few people that I know who really likes the rain. I got up really early this morning and I started to work on editing the interviews for the shows that I'm recording. And I worked from, 5:30 to 11 or 12. And suddenly I got what I think other people mean when they say they're stir crazy. I suddenly felt I have to get out of the house. This almost never happens to me. I don't really remember it happening to me before. And there's actually a Yiddish word for this. It's spilkes. It means you can't sit still. You must move. Well, it's raining. But I had to get out of the house. So I have a raincoat. And I put on my raincoat, and it has a hood. And I drove to the beach. I live 5 blocks from the beach. But it's raining. So I drove to the beach, and I parked the car. And I see that there are no cars parked in our little parking lot. And I got out, and to my delight, it was just kind of misty drizzle. So I took my raincoat off and I slung it around my shoulders. You know, I tied it in front the way you do with sweatshirts and stuff, because it's warm still. And I put on a baseball cap and I walked on the beach in the rain. I was the only human being on the beach. Me, the puddles, the water, the sand, and the birds. Wow. I'm walking and I'm thinking, this gives new meaning to the words, my beach. I never wear shoes when I walk on the beach because there's something about the feel of the sand on my feet that changes my chemistry. And I'm a water sign, so I never can get enough of the water. I slosh around in the water, at the edge of the water. Like we used to do it when I was a kid with the leaves that fell, because I don't live in a place where leaves fall anymore, but I grew up in a place where leaves fell. And we would run through the leaves, and well, I run through the water now. So I'm walking on the beach, and I can't get over it. It's gray and it's cloudy, but I love it. And it's sort of misty, and I'm wearing my baseball cap, and I'm singing at the top of my lungs, because you can do that on the beach when there's nobody there and the birds don't care. And suddenly, flying overhead, there's this formation of these astonishing-looking birds. And I am not a bird watcher. I don't know what they're called. Sometimes I don't even notice. But these birds were black on top. Their wings were all black, and their back and their head. And white underneath their wings and on their underside. And they had red-orange beaks. And they reminded me of that old kid's joke, what's black and white and red all over? The newspaper? So I watched them and I breathed the beautiful, wonderful air. We're supposed to have negative ions on my beach, which is supposed to be really wonderful for you. And I'm walking the walk I always walk, right? And enjoying the hell out of it. And then, off in the distance, I saw another person, and I became apprehensive. And this is so disappointing to me. Suddenly, I became aware of the fact that I didn't bring my cell phone, and I'm not wearing that much underneath my t-shirt and my raincoat. And I'm 15 or 20 minutes from the car, and I'm a fair walk from the houses that are back from the beach, and I can't tell who this person is. And I don't want to feel this, but I do. So I turned around and I started to walk back at a clip. No more leisure, no more enjoying the birds and the wind and the water and my stopping singing, of course. And every once in a while I looked back to see if that person was gaining on me, and that person was not gaining on me. So after three or four times looking back, and that person was, wherever they were, still about the same distance behind me, I slowed down a bit. But the magic was really gone. And when I got to the place where I turn off to go to the parking lot, I looked back and that person was still the same distance behind me that they had been. And it made me feel so bad, because I could have walked, I could have continued along and said hello to this person who, like me, is the only other person who wanted to, who enjoyed, who reveled in having the beach in this wonderful misty day to ourselves. But I didn't. So, okay, that's... I wanted to tell somebody. So I'm telling you, I don't know who you are. I have no idea who's listening. And I also don't know whether you've been listening, or this is the first time you've listened and you're thinking, what is this show? Well, okay. I will now revert to what I usually do, which is talk about the concepts in my book, the book When You Can, You Will, which you can also find on the website if you go up there. And then I will play the current interview in my series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I have been just enjoying the hell out of interviewing these remarkably interesting, funny, charming, talented people. And then I'll play some music. I guess I'll play a song first and then talk about the serious content in the show. So here come a song.
Life out there, it's crazy. I limp home lame and lazy. And I'm so glad to see there ain't no one but me that I've got to satisfy. Oh, the sweet single life. Oh, oh, the sweet single life. I'm nobody's mother and nobody's wife, and I'm nobody's living maid. Oh, I'm no cheerleader in no one's parade. Oh, the sweet. There's more on that vine. If I find I'm lonely some night, whoa, whoa, the sweet single life. Oh,
don't know, obviously, I don't know what your experience around being single or being married was, is. But my experience was that I was the very last person I knew who got married. Everybody got married before me, including my baby sister. And I spent most of my waking life, when I wasn't compelled to think about or do something else, thinking about this, worrying about it, aggravating over it, beating myself up over it, and wondering what the hell was wrong with me. I spent so much time and energy thinking about why I wasn't married that I missed a lot of my life, which was terrific. And then one day, I woke up and noticed that I was living in Los Angeles. It was the 70s. I was in the music business. I was single. And I was having a terrific time. I really loved my life. This was a huge surprise to me. Very, very, very different from anything that I had experienced before. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, who knows how long I'm going to go on feeling like this. I should take advantage of this and write a song about this. I should write a song about how good it can be to be single. And so, of course, I wrote The Sweet Single Life, which you just heard. And, of course, the very first time I played it in a club, the man I was dating, had just begun to date at the time, said to me, oh, you know, that song, The Sweet Single Life, that's just how I felt. And we both agreed that it was really good to be single. And so, of course, he's the guy I married. Now, some would say that I had to arrive at acceptance of my life in order to change it. And I wouldn't argue with that. Maybe that was what my unconscious was trying to tell me. Lighten up. Anyway, now I'm going to talk to you about your unconscious and how it is protecting you and me from things that we need to be protected from. As I explained last time, the difference between the conscious and the unconscious mind for most of us is that we're aware of the information that's coming from our conscious mind. That's because our conscious mind communicates to us through thought. What we're thinking is coming from our conscious mind. So mostly we approve of it, we listen to it, we take it seriously, and in this culture it's very valued. But information coming to us from our unconscious mind usually comes to us through our behavior. That is, our behavior is controlled to some extent by the intent of our unconscious mind. So if you hear yourself saying something you didn't intend to say, you know, the old Freudian slip about which I will speak later, or doing something that you didn't mean to do and maybe even didn't want to do, that behavior is almost always coming from our unconscious mind. And because it seems to us that it's out of our control, it's terribly undervalued. In fact, it can be disregarded, it can be denied, we can be afraid of it and very uncomfortable with it. So because we recognize and can observe the workings of our conscious mind, we tend to like it and use the information coming from it. And because we can't usually observe the workings of our unconscious mind, we tend to disregard it and maybe even be afraid of it. But although they operate very differently in our lives, both of our minds help us make the changes we want to make. Changes that don't endanger us. They aren't about to have us blow a cover or expose undercover qualities. They're not going to put us in the realm of a future or a past danger. They're not going to expose feelings that we can't bear to feel. Those changes are the province of the conscious mind. Our conscious mind is clever. It's resourceful. It can help us accomplish many, many things that we want to do. Our conscious mind contains all of our analytical skills, and it uses them to solve our problems. But our conscious mind doesn't know everything that there is to know about us. It's unaware, for example, of traits and memories that in self-defense we have had to deny. And as I explained in an earlier show, whenever you experienced an event or a feeling that was too painful for you to tolerate, or whenever you recognized something about yourself that was too dangerous to reveal, even from your conscious mind, your unconscious mind took it and hid it not only from the outside world, but from you yourself. Your unconscious mind is the keeper of these dangerous secrets, and it will hold them under wraps until you can bear to know them. Recognizing and protecting you from danger is the job of your unconscious mind. It hides the dark mysteries of your life from everyone, including your conscious mind. Your conscious mind may be encouraging you to leap off the growing edge into a future danger or dive off the diving board into a past danger, but it can only do that because it doesn't see the danger. When your conscious mind is saying, "Go ahead, it's no big deal, jump, jump, jump," it's your unconscious mind that sees the danger and stops you. It will obstruct any change that your conscious mind tries to force on you before you're ready. Your unconscious can alter your behavior without the consent or even the awareness of your conscious mind. It can cause you to say things you didn't mean to say and do things you didn't mean to do. Have you ever heard yourself saying something you immediately wanted to stuff back in your mouth? Well, you'd be really unusual if you hadn't. Your unconscious can even alter what you think and what you remember, as well as what you say and do. And I have a very powerful memory of an example of that. Many years ago, I had a job interview scheduled for Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When Monday came, however, somehow I remembered that that appointment was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Halfway there, I suddenly realized my mistake. I arrived at 4 o'clock, right on time, an hour late. Now, I have a responsible cover, and if you need information about what cover means, you can get it by going up on my website, checking on podcasts, and clicking on the podcast in which I describe the cover and cover story, or getting the book or the work. Oh, never mind. So I've got a responsible cover. And confusing the appointment time is so unusual for me that I knew that my unconscious was operating, that it was saying essentially, "Don't take this job." So while I apologized deeply, I didn't make another appointment because I trust the behavior coming from my unconscious. But most of my clients don't, and many are skeptical and deeply afraid of their unconscious. And I always encourage them to be on the lookout for surprising interventions that their unconscious may devise, such as slips of the tongue, slips of the mind, and behaviors that are unexpected or out of character, like mine with that job interview. I encourage them to expect their unconscious to aid them in unforeseen ways. And I had a client named Wendy to whom I told this story about missing the appointment. Wendy was somebody who had complete confidence in her conscious mind and her "trust me, I'm in control" cover. She was astonished when, for 3 weeks running, she got our appointment time wrong. She came late, she came at the wrong time, she came at the wrong day, she forgot it altogether. She was really upset by this behavior. It scared her to think that she was losing control. When she recognized the specificity and elegance of this particular choice that was made by her unconscious, she was amazed. It was doing exactly what I had described. It was altering the times of remembered appointments, something that, of course, never happened in her life. And when she realized that far from being out of control, her unconscious was controlling the situation perfectly. It was duplicating exactly the example I had given her. When Wendy accepted that her unconscious could orchestrate her forgotten appointments, she stopped getting them wrong immediately. and she went back to being in control of when she got to see me. Understanding that her unconscious could act on her behalf changed her self-image. She'd always thought of herself as somebody who had to struggle to keep a tight grip on the reins of her life. She believed she needed to stay in control. Now, Wendy had come into therapy to lighten up, to find a way to relax and enjoy her life. But before she could risk making this change, she had to know that she could trust herself. That as long as she believed that she was limited to her conscious talents, she felt compelled to be vigilant. But by demonstrating its power to act in her life, Wendy's unconscious was actually encouraging her to lighten up. So, do you, like Wendy, think of yourself as a no-nonsense, logical kind of person? Do you pride yourself on your ability to reason, to analyze, to figure things out? Have you ignored or even ridiculed information which came to you or others from alternative sources like impulses, dreams, hunches, feelings, or intuitions? If so, then you're probably primarily, maybe even exclusively, identified with your conscious mind. Now, your conscious mind, with its logical and analytical skills, is a very, very valuable tool, but it's not the only one you have. If it's the only one you recognize, you're shortchanging yourself. If you believe, like Wendy, that it's your only resource, then you may be cheating yourself out of a very important asset. Your unconscious mind can contain disturbing information. It might be holding despised undercover qualities which would have gotten you in danger if you exposed them earlier. It might contain dangerous emotions which, when you previously demonstrated them, caused a consequence that you don't want to repeat. It might have frightening memories even. But as long as you can't bear to feel, expose, reveal, or acknowledge these painful information, your unconscious will keep you from recognizing it. If the change you want to make, anything from applying to graduate school, getting a job, or filing for divorce, threatens to expose some of this information before you can tolerate it or put it to good use, your unconscious will stop you from making the change. And until you understand that your unconscious is protecting you by keeping you from doing these things, you might be thinking of it as an enemy, a saboteur, a guerrilla fighter who's undermining you from within. But believing that your unconscious is the enemy only condemns you to fight a war you cannot win, a war against yourself. And I will be saying more about this either later in this show or in the next show. This is what I call our civil war. Okay, enough serious talk. I'm going to play another song before I play the interview with Judy Lyons-Schneider. Remember, you're supposed to be listening to these songs and helping me decide whether any of them would be better to start the show. That's probably grammatically wrong. It would be better to start or end my show with one of these as opposed to "You Really Can" or "I Won't Go With a Whimper." Earlier I played "The Sweet Single Life," which I wrote right before I met and the guy I was going to marry. This song is the first song I wrote for him after I actually moved in with him. I moved in, and he immediately went on the road. He's a musician. And I was literally there, I think, a week and a half, and the phone rang, and I said, "Hello," and this voice said, "Hi, this is Tom Waits." And my husband was gone for most of the next year, which was a good and a bad thing, which maybe I'll talk about it another time. We needed the money, God knows. We were so broke. Anyway, this is the song I wrote for him as he flew away. It's called "Traveling Man."
She's standing at the dock, just waving her goodbye. to a boat, to a man, too far away to see. Her smiling face is locked, she's not about to cry. Not the wife of a man who makes his living from the sea. She's a woman who loves a traveling man, and she knows what a woman should be. She's a woman who loves a traveling man, a woman who loves like me. She's leaning on the fence, waving her goodbye to a horse, to a man. Somewhere in the rust, she's got no common sense. She never wonders why. She's in love with a man who makes his living scuffling in the dust. She's a woman who loves a traveling. And she knows what a woman should be. She's a woman who loves a traveling man, a woman who loves like me. She's gotta keep the home fires burning. That her cover blown, and I'm standing at the gate waving my goodbye to a plane, to a man who'll be far away too long. All I can do is wait and watch the time crawl by for the love of a man who makes his living with a song. I'm a woman who loves a traveling man, and all that I ever want to be.
One of the good things that came out of that trip was that my husband discovered Sarasota, Florida. Tom had been booked into the Van Wezel, which is a performing venue here in Sarasota, with Leon Redbone opening for him. This at that time was almost entirely a retirement community. I don't know whose idea it was to book Tom Waits. And by the way, what do you call that? My mimicking of his voice, that wasn't very good. I'm sorry, Tom. Anyway, they played Sarasota, and they had another gig, which was canceled right behind the one in Sarasota. And the job after that was in New Jersey. And it was wintertime. It was Thanksgiving, I think. And so they had to choose whether to stay that week in Sarasota or to spend that week in New Jersey. Well, that was a no-brainer. They spent that week in Sarasota, Florida on Lido Key. And he came home saying, "Oh, Sarasota, Sarasota, Sarasota." And I, in my ignorance and arrogance, said, "Florida? Are you kidding? I'm a New Yorker. We know about Florida. You go there to die. You go there on spring break. You go there if you don't get into medical school, but nobody goes there to live." Well, 10 years later, he asked me when I had been in Florida, and I had to admit that I had not ever been to Florida. And he made me go, and I so fell in love with it that we bought the house I am currently living in then, although we rented it and went home to L.A., and that's another story I will tell another time, if I ever remember that I told this much of it. So now you've heard a lot about me, and it's time for you to hear some about Judy Lyons Schneider. This, of course, is the continuation of my interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. I just am more and more and more thrilled at the people that I'm getting to meet and talk to. As you can hear from the music that I'm playing and the fact that I married a musician, comfortable with music and musicians, I'm not very visual and I don't know that much about art, although I have friends who are fine artists. But that way of being in the world, that way of taking in things through your eyes and then making graphic things with them, that's somewhat alien to me. So it's with great interest, it was with great interest that I interviewed Judy and will be looking forward to talking to more artists who make their life, their living with their eyes and their hands. But now, here, Judy Lyons Schneider. I am here with Judy Lyons Schneider in her beautiful home that is absolutely filled with her work. I met Judy because she is a friend of a friend of mine. I was here by accident because my friend was visiting me and she said we have to go see Judy's studio, and so I got to see this work, which is quite extraordinary, and I was very... It had an impact on me. So Judy is an artist, and I'm not sure how much I told you. I'm doing this series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist, and I'm wanting to interview people who have made their living or their life with their work. And you have clearly been doing this for a lifetime.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, this is a body of work that you don't do in a, you know, you didn't start in the last few years and without all this stuff.
No, that's true.
And one of the impacts one of the reasons it impacted me so much was the sheer volume and the variety of stuff, which suggests to me not only length of time, but, you know, development, right? So I tell everybody I don't have an agenda and I don't have questions. I'm just interested in how you found it, how you arrived at it, what your early influences were, whatever you want to say about it.
Well, you make mention to the volume of the work, and it is kind of frightening because... as much as I sell it, I produce even more. And it's something I can't help myself from doing. It's just something I do.
Twas ever thus?
As a kid, I loved to draw. And I guess I take after my mom in the way that I'm a big saver. After she passed away, I found in with her things the first watercolor painting that I had ever done.
How old were you?
I was about 7 or 8.
Wow.
And it's something that I've always done on some level, but it wasn't until I no longer had my day job that I could devote myself to it 100%.
Well, did you study? I mean, you're talking about a day job. I'm assuming you were an adult by then.
Right. I did study, but I've not, unfortunately, had really extensive education. You know, it's been sort of self-education.
Yeah, I wasn't so much asking, technical question. I was wondering whether you drew as a kid and then you just didn't think that was a career, or you didn't have the time or the money for it, or, you know.
Well, I always drew and painted. There was always a pencil in my hand, and my parents had a close friend who had an art supply store.
Clever.
I grew up in New York City, and it was fabulous because whenever Ben and Anita would come to visit my mom, Ben always had some little goodie. And when he saw the joy it gave me, I guess, it spurred him on. And when came time for college, I wanted to study art, and I was informed by my parents that that was fine, but it had to be become an art teacher. At that point in my life, that was not something that I wanted to do. And so, although I went to school, after a couple of years, I was only 18 at the time, and a marriage opportunity arose, and I thought that was better than teaching. It's what you call learning the hard way.
Yes.
But, you know, I always did things that could have been making greeting cards for the family, which I stopped because if kids were sick and I didn't have time to make a greeting card for one relative and they then saw someone else got something, I'd hear about it. So that was a way. In the evenings, I would work. I would take classes or was part of a workshop that met upstairs in a firehouse in Bogota, New Jersey, and did portraits. And so, you know, I was always...
So it's always, it was always a part of your life.
Absolutely. And if it wasn't, I wasn't happy. But my dream was to be able to do it full time. Mm-hmm. And I've been so involved in the art community and doing my work that I sort of wonder, how did I ever have time to lead a life in the past?
What do you mean?
Well, I think when I was working in the city, I was working 5 and 4 days a week, and I was involved in all sorts of things. I painted, I took a printmaking workshop for a couple of years, and I got all these things done.
You had a lot of energy.
Right, I guess that's it. And, you know, now with the organizations that I'm involved in, the various art organizations, and spending time in my studio, I seem to have no spare time. If I had to do extra things, I don't know when I could do it. And I guess the answer really is the energy.
Well, I think youth has a kind of energy that age doesn't necessarily have, although I have seen some people who seem to hold on to it. But I also think there's necessity. You know, I'm assuming that some of the stuff you did, you had to do.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And it's the mother of energy.
You know, you do what you have
to do. You do what you have to do is exactly right. Yeah. And it's entirely possible that if you had to do it now, you'd find it, but you don't have to, so...
Yeah. Yeah. That really is true. But I know that one of the things that I really love to do and that inspires a lot of my work and is responsible for a lot of different approaches to it is travel.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because it's clear. I mean, there are things all over your house that clearly didn't come from here.
Right.
And the influences in your work are so clear. Mm. So you want to talk a little bit about how you discovered that, how that started?
I guess in looking around the house, just what comes my vision is a large charcoal drawing. Mm-hmm. And that was done after my first husband died.
I'm turning around to look at it.
And
oh, my gosh.
And that's quite different from the other things that
yes.
you've seen.
Do you want to describe this? I mean, I looked at it and I may have that response to it, but, you know, we're on radio, so. So can you?
I'll try. It's about 80 inches wide, and I remember the width because I had a real problem fitting it into a vehicle to get to show it at an exhibition that I had many years ago. But it's a charcoal drawing that's abstract, and it's called Dancing Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
It's four sheets of paper that are butted together.
Aha! Uh-huh.
And I've drawn, you know, right across them.
Yes. And there are these dancing black charcoal shapes.
Right.
Yeah. They could be flying, too.
Right. People have seen them say, oh, dolphins. And the idea is it's just kind of spirits, and it's charcoal, but in various forms. It just reflects the thought that I hope that my late husband was dancing out there somewhere, that he was in a much more peaceful place.
Okay, so a certain amount of your work mm-hmm. is generated by some experience that you're having that you see a visual form for. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Would you say that that's how all of it is generated?
No. Sometimes the materials themselves
ask for something.
And one of those things is when I work with encaustics, which are hot waxes, and there's something about the material that lends itself to me to a certain look, and I just kind of work with the medium.
Yeah, it evolved.
Right.
Or it emerges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like the collages. One never knows what will start. That piece over there is a collage that's on paper, and it's got oil paint on it as well. And although it looks light, it's really got many, many, many layers on it. And what started that was something that I had done many years ago, an oil drawing on paper. Because I love the way paints mixed with the surface of paper. And
you're rubbing your hands. Do you mean tactily? Do you
yes.
mean the way it feels when you are putting the paint on
right.
the paper? Oh,
right.
That's great.
Yeah. I don't know if there's such a word, but I would describe myself privately as a tactilian. Well, on this particular piece, I had done a drawing, and I had framed it and had exhibited it. And when I moved down here to Florida, I had to remove a lot of my artwork from frames because it just was too bulky
right,
to
ship.
Transport. Mm-hmm. And it was a good opportunity to get rid of some of the things. Why am I keeping this and so forth? And the particular pieces that I'm referring to were very tall. They were long. And I decided to keep them in the frames. It was just easier. I didn't have boxes that I could just slip these into. And when I came down, was setting up my studio, and I come to this, and I looked at this piece, and I said, what was I thinking? I showed this? You know, and I took it out of the frame, and I started to tear it. And I tore some of the images. And I kind of like them away from this long piece.
This is a part of something?
That's a part of something.
Oh, my God.
And there are a pair of pieces that I did with images that I removed.
That's
so
great.
It's recycled.
Yes.
And yet working in my studio, which overlooks a preserve.
Mm-hmm. I just want to stop you. I'm in Judy's house, and oh, is this the gardener that's making all this noise?
Yes.
Oh,
sorry about that.
Well, I just don't know. Okay, so what you hear is the gardener riding around on something.
It's a lawnmower.
He's riding around on a lawnmower. That's exactly right. So that's what the hum in the background is, and there'll be no way I can edit it out, so...
And he's really not usually here this day
of course week, not. Right? Of course not. You know, I was thinking when you were talking about recycling the paper. I hope you guys can hear us over the... But I'm fairly sure you can. I'm going to stop this and listen.
So I did stop the interview here, and we waited while the gardeners finished gardening, and Judy and I chatted while they were doing that, and as a result, when I picked the interview back up, I didn't remember where we were. You'll hear that if you listen next week, because that's where I'm picking up the interview next week. So this seemed a perfect place to interrupt the interview, and so I did. I hope that you'll tune in again next week, because the rest of the interview is not only illuminating from the point of view of an artist and her process and her techniques, but it's also funny. So I'm going to close the show soon. But before I do, I need to say, as I always do, a huge thank you to the computer recording electronic genius who comes and makes sure that all of my shows sound as good as they can possibly sound, and who helps me when I run into trouble, which I often do, although less and less. I was going to say more and more, but less and less. As I have begun to learn things, he assures me that I'm doing very well. Thank you, Josh. Anyway, it is Josh Hackney, my computer guru. And as I always say at some point in the show, if you have computer issues, recording issues, electronic issues, phone issues, you want Josh. And as I probably should say again, I'm always thinking when I listen to radio shows, why isn't that person telling us again how to get in touch with them? And now I know why, because we forget. So how you get in touch with me and Josh, if you want to, is by going up on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's L-Y-N-N-E, thelynnshow.com. You want to be sure to add the E, because there's a The Lynn Show that's not me without the E. And probably I should say that all of the material that I talked about today comes from my book, When You Can, You Will, which is available, although limitedly, from my website. And that, as I have said before in the show, you can listen to previous shows by going up on that website and clicking on the podcasts. I'm going to talk a little bit about having gone to the beach later in the day. I talked in the beginning about having gone to the beach in the morning by myself, the only person on the beach for most of the walk. Well, I went back, and this is what happened. I went back to walk on the beach this evening. I didn't realize that it was just at sunset when I got there. You can't see the sun from the entrance from the parking lot, but I knew that it was sunset because there were all these people standing in little clumps looking towards the west. Every night at my beach, people stand and wait for the sunset. Tonight, the clouds went almost all the way down to the horizon, but not quite. There was just enough room for this huge orange ball of a sun. And there was one little spray of cloud going across it, making it look like a big beach ball. And we all stood there the way we all do every night and watched it go into the sea. There were people there every night watching the sun go down, and sometimes they applaud. Often, almost always, there are people taking pictures of the sunset or of loved ones standing in front of the sunset. Tonight it was really spectacular, and I walked again. Of course, tonight there were lots of people there. It felt more like it usually does. But I will never forget this morning's experience and what it was like to have the beach all to myself. Okay, so that was my experience on the beach. And I don't know if that was of interest to you or not. I talked a lot about myself in the show today, which I don't usually do. I hope that you found it interesting. Actually, I hope that you found something in this show interesting or useful or enjoyable or funny or something that you want to take away with you and that would make you want to tune in again next time. Next time being next Tuesday, same time, same station. That's the Radio Ear Network, 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 10 o'clock L.A. time. And as you now know, I lived in L.A. for a long time. And Mondays, 3 o'clock in the morning for our friends over the pond, as they say, or jazz musicians just getting home. So, this is the Lynn Show. I will be here next week. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night.
Tune in again next week when I will continue to talk about the unconscious and describe what I mean when I say that we are in civil war with ourselves, and I'll play the rest of the interview with Judy Lyons Schneider.
I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may